Welcome to Babbittville Radio, a place where you'll hear great conversations with the world's best and most inspirational runners, triathletes, and cyclists. Endurance lives here. Now, here's your host, USA Triathlon and Ironman Triathlon Hall of Famer, Bob Babbitt.
Welcome to Babbittville Radio. My name is Bob Babbitt. We're brought to you by the Tough Man Triathlon Series. That's toughmantri.com. By VeloFix.com, the world's coolest mobile bike shop. By Polar, blood, sweat, and data. By CaliforniaTriathlon.org, they've got five great 2019 race options, including Viking Dash Trail Run LA on April 7th. By our Challenged Athletes Foundation in 2018, we sent out 2,806 grants, totaling $4.3 million. Keep challenged athletes in the game of life through sport. To help out, go to challengedathletes.org and check out any of our interviews on iTunes or at Babbittville.com. As always, endurance lives here. Our next guest, a former professional basketball player. Now he's hoping to become an Ironman one day. His name is Sebastian Bellin. Sebastian, how you doing?
Pretty good. Thanks for having me on your show. Well, I appreciate it.
Oh, Sebastian, I'm honored to have you on the show. So first of all, how does somebody, you were born in Brazil, and you played basketball in Italy and in Belgium, and also lived in the States. You're sort of Mr. All-Around-the-World guy.
Yeah, I had a kind of a unique upbringing. My dad worked for American companies.
Yeah.
You know, he's a corporate world, and traveled all around the world, from Brazil to Indianapolis, Philadelphia, Denmark, Italy. I lived on three continents of the world before the age of 10. So I had a really unique and wonderful, let's say, upbringing, childhood. And eventually it brought me to getting a scholarship. I played college basketball in the States, and then 15 years professional, like you said, in Italy and in Belgium. So, basketball's given me a lot.
Yeah, 11 different teams you played for. Belgian League champion 2007, two-time Belgian Cup winner 2008-2011. So, basketball, what was it about that sport? Did you play in high school as well?
Yeah, I played in high school, but, I was a little bit of a nerd in high school. I went to a really good, let's say, academic school in Brussels, the International School of Brussels. And it was, I've always been a sports freak, but academics was pretty important, like especially languages. So basketball is kind of an outlet, and I kept growing and growing and growing. And, you know, when you're 6'7", 6'8", when you're a sophomore in high school, you kind of have to be pushed towards that kind of basketball. And I started playing in ninth grade, I think, the first time I touched a basketball, and I just loved it and stayed with it. And so it was really an outlet, physical outlet to my studies that I found fascinating.
How many languages do you speak?
I speak four languages.
Wow. You're amazing. So after basketball, was it a tough transition for you? A lot of times athletes are so much of their identity is the sport they play, but it seems like you were such a well-rounded guy. Did you transition fairly quickly out of basketball?
That's a great question. You know, the thing is, I always laugh with ex-teammates, is that I had the advantage, Bob, of never being the best guy on the team or the best player. You know, I always played for top teams, but I was always a role player, and I understood my role. So I knew that basketball was always going to be just a stepping stone for something. And I had a 15-year career, but during my entire career, I was always interested in technology and in different things. And so when I retired from basketball, with two buddies of mine, we started a little company that was the world's first automated video production system. So we could live stream a basketball game 100% automatically. No cameraman, no operator was necessary. We started that company in 2012, and we sold it to a group of investors in New York in 2015. So actually, you know, to answer your question, the transition, I kind of planned it all along.
Right. You were working on it throughout your career. The career was sort of a stepping stone to what you were going to do next.
Exactly. And I think that's one of the things which, in these days now, I help a lot of these pro athletes to keep it real, so to speak. You know, hey guys, one day this ends.
Right.
And there's a lot of things that you can do now, you know, to put yourself in the right situation to have a good stepping stone to the next chapter in your life.
So when you sell the company, did you stay on board with the company after you sold?
Yes. Yes. We sold, the new owners gave me a 2-year contract to create and scale the company, on the U.S. market. And that's why, we moved my wife and I and our two kids moved to Michigan, where we bought a little house, in the middle of nowhere in Battle Creek, Michigan. Yeah. Yeah. Where she's from, and we started. I started traveling back and forth from Battle Creek and our new offices in New York and our offices in Belgium.
So March 22nd, 2016, you're in the Brussels airport flying back to New York, I assume.
Yes. Yeah. Well, I had just finished up a week or 2 weeks. I can't really remember of business meetings and everything for that company in Europe, Paris and Brussels, and then I was flying back, to go to a board meeting in New York.
Well, but even so, weren't you? Was it the night before that you were out to dinner in France?
No, I had been in Paris all day with meetings with the National Basketball League, the French Basketball League, and I had gotten back to Brussels really late. And I got a phone call from a buddy of mine begging me to come out to eat at this little Italian place joint that I really like in Brussels. And so, you know, I didn't want to go, and I hung up on him. He kept calling me back a few times, and finally, like, he persisted, and we went out to eat that night, and I had the most amazing bowl or portions of pasta carbonara, and those. You know, to go further, that pasta is really what saved my life. You know, one of the reasons that saved my life, because I inhaled so much of glucose, so much of you know, carbs, that I had a stockpile in me to endure the next day. You know, the events of the next day.
What I love is you inhaled it so quickly. I think the waiter came up and said, "What'd you think?" And you're like, "Wow, that was great, but man, I need more." And the chef came out and gave you another portion.
Yeah, two more portions.
Two more portions.
But I was like, "Listen, your quality is amazing, but your quantity really sucks. You know, like, you got to work on your quantity." And so he got offended. He's like, "Well, listen, at least I have the quality." I said, "Yeah, you definitely have the quality, but your quantity, you know, for a big guy like me, We need to improve that." So he brought me back two more portions, and that's why, you know, it's one of the reasons I can really attribute my survival is just I was literally stuffed with carbs.
So
my carbo loaded.
The next morning, you're at the airport, and then you had the attack at the Brussels airport. Bullet shattered your right hip. You were using blood, nearly losing your legs. Talk a little bit about just that experience, because one of the things you talk about when you present to people is you talk about staying calm in the heat of battle and not being afraid, and understand that that's something you take from sports, because you're always in sports in chaotic situations. Well, this is a life-threatening chaotic situation. But talk about what you drew from sport that really helped you be where you are, be alive.
Yeah. Well, you know, sports and any athlete will tell you that it's not always positive. You know, there are moments where you're either behind 20 points, where you're injured, where there's a lot of adversity towards you, and you don't have a choice but to find a way to overcome that. And so, you know, when the second bomb went off, and I was about 5 yards from the second bomb, and I saw just, you know, when I came to and I saw just hell around me, I was actually lucky to have a dead woman like right next to me. And this dead woman, you know, her face was looking right at me, of course, motionless. And from that moment on, something just ignited in me to say, "Listen, I'm one of the lucky ones. You know, this woman right here is dead. and my legs are almost shattered. I mean, are shattered. They're almost torn off me, but I survived. So from that very moment, I was not a victim. I was a survivor. And that switch in mind frame from being, okay, I'm feeling sorry for myself, being a victim, to a survivor, meaning, holy, you know, I just survived a severe bomb blast, and now I got to fight my way to overcome that. I'm not going to, you know, the hardest part is done. I got to stay alive now and find a way to overcome this experience. And so I started really climbing my way back, just like in a game, you know, or just like adversity in sports. You just got to find a way to get it done. And anything works. Anything works. It's little step by steps, chip away at that 20-point gap that the other team has. And sure enough, it worked.
Well, and first of all, it's not like everybody's running in and helping people out. People are worried other bombs are going off. So people are just trying to get the hell out of there.
Oh, people forget. I mean, when they see the picture that went around the world
of you laying there in a pool of your own blood.
Yeah, that's actually the good part,
right?
Because you know, like half an hour before, I'm in the middle of hell.
Right.
You know, I'm in the middle of like, and I was dragged to that point, and I was for an hour and a half in the airport. Because you know, it's fighting for my life. Because, like you said, the police are trying to secure the other parts of the airport, the firemen, the aid workers. Like they don't really know what's going on. So there's chaos. So it's really you have to stay calm, and you have to kind of coach people to be like, okay, this is what my gut instinct is telling me. This is what I need. And you have to coach, you know, the people
right.
around you. Say, look, guys, let's do this.
Well,
you know, let's get this done.
You need to get. You also need to mobilize them to help you. You're 6'9", 250 pounds. You're a big person for somebody to move, and you're basically saying, "Hey, listen, grab that luggage cart, get me on the luggage cart, and get me out of here." Because people are. It's not like people are volunteering to come help you.
Yeah. Well, and then the second part is, you know, the sight of my legs. You know, people didn't know whether my legs were still attached. So, you know, it's not really nice to lift up, you know, shattered legs
right.
onto a baggage cart. So you have to coax people to be like, it's all right, let's do this. You know, you have to motivate people to say, don't worry, you know, we'll get through this. And so there is a lot of psychological coaching. There is a lot of, you know, all the coaches I've had kind of blended in to me kind of rallying the people around me to say, let's do this, guys. You know, let's get me to the front of the airport. Let's find the right game plan or tactic to for me to survive this horrible event.
Did you have to basically say, listen, if you guys leave me here, it's going to be on your conscience that I died here? I mean, did you have to prompt people to come help?
Yeah, because at one point the police and the military that were there refused to. I was on the cart. I had finally gotten on the cart, and they refused to leave me to let me go to the front of the airport to be pushed to the front of the airport. They're like, no, you got to stay here. And you know, Bob, I was very conscious
right.
the whole time, and I saw how much blood I was losing. I mean, and I felt. You know, I felt that loss of sensation creep up, you know, in me, and I knew I didn't have a lot of time. So I had to be very vocal to police, to rescue workers. I said, listen, if I stay here, I'm going to die, and you will have it on your conscience, because I had to find a way to make it click, you know, to make them realize that, listen, no matter what, if I stay here, you know, I'm going to die. And if I go and you're afraid of me, you know, other terrorists, well, anyways, it's a lose-lose for me. So get me to the front of the airport where my chances are the best and let me handle it. And so that's what happened. Like a young airport worker just pushed me to the front of the airport, and I was just stranded there for like a few minutes, you know, all by myself in this chaos. And then thankfully about six firemen came around the corner and saw me. and then lifted up the baggage cart and took me outside and then rolled me to the triage place just at the fire station down the road from the airport.
So in terms of taking care of yourself, you also, then you grabbed your scarf and and that became a tourniquet. You put your legs up on a suitcase to try to slow down the bleeding. You did whatever it took to save yourself.
Well, I think that's, you know, I think that's the advantage of what we talked about briefly before, of that I did not allow fear to take over me.
Yeah.
Because I consider myself a survivor, not a victim.
Right.
So I was, even though I was in danger of dying, I hadn't died. I was alive. I was a survivor. And when you eliminate fear from your reality, Bob, opportunities start opening up. And I think that's the message I give a lot to people, is people live more and more with fear. And fear blinds people. It saps, like, positive energy from them. People, you know, they see their kid climbing in a tree, and all of a sudden the kid will be like, and they're thinking, oh, my God, he's going to fall. She's going to fall, and she's going to break her leg. Well, no, she's having fun in the tree. You know what I mean? They're having a great time. You're assuming they're going to fall. And so this fear grips people. And when you have fear gripping you, it's very difficult to see opportunities. And I didn't have that fear. I'm not saying I wasn't realistic of the danger I was in, but there's a big difference between fear and danger. There's a huge difference. Danger is a car come at you full speed. That's dangerous. You got to move out of the way. But fear is getting up in the morning thinking, oh my God, I'm going to get hit by a car today. It's like it's kind of complete illusion. And that saps the positivity and energy that you have. And so in that moment, because I didn't have fear, all of a sudden I saw all these opportunities. You know, I saw a scarf that was laying. I mean, you look at the picture, there's a scarf right there to my right. You know, there's a little suitcase that was able to pull over and elevate my legs onto the suitcase, waiting for help. So I stopped the flow of blood. I used a scarf for a tourniquet. And it's a funny, you know, there's no coincidences, but life had put everything I needed to survive. Life had put it there. But I was just lucky enough to see the opportunities that life had placed there and use them to my benefit.
So when you're out in front of the hospital in front of the airport, and we chatted about you had eaten a big meal the night before, so you weren't passing out. With the amount of blood flow, I think you lose about 50% of your blood. With the amount of blood loss you were having, the typical thing would you would have passed out. And they were putting colors on people. Like, they were putting, okay, this is green, he's okay. This is yellow, maybe he's okay. Red, get him to the hospital right away. Black, he's too far gone, don't worry about him. And if you were passed out, there's a good chance they would have put a black one on you, and we wouldn't be talking right now.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's staying focused. You know, that's staying focused on the objective. And yes, because of the energy and the will and the pasta,
right,
to sustain me through those horrific injuries. Yeah, I stayed awake and I was able to implement my game plan. And so when they came around, because in the triage place, that exactly like you said, they rank you. So a green is like, listen, it's a scratch. You know, don't waste your time. It's fine. You're going to be fine. A yellow one is, it's starting to be serious, but not the priority. A red one is absolutely first one to the hospital, you know, because this person is on the verge of dying. And a black one is too late. You know, there's nothing more we can do for them. They're going to die anyway. Don't waste your time on this person. Which sounds crazy to say, but that's the reality of huge, you know, when there's so much chaos, when there's so much injury and death, well, they have to rank you. And I got a red one. I got a red one. So I was able to look at the person that was deciding whether you were going to get a yellow, a red, or a black. And, you know, to see a 6'9 guy passed out, you know, with my legs practically torn off me with blood everywhere, yeah, I might have gotten a black.
Definitely.
And we wouldn't be here. But I looked at the guy in the face. I said, listen, I need an ambulance, really. And I was sweating so much. You know, the guy was like wide open, eyes wide open. I got a red, and I was immediately put into one of the first ambulances to the hospital.
And meanwhile, your wife, Sarah, is at home. And I think she got a text saying, you know, we're praying for Seb. Hope he's okay. She didn't do nothing, right? Until when she first somebody told her about what was basically saying, we're so sorry for you, she went online, and the first image she sees is you laying in a pool of blood at the Brussels airport.
Yeah, you know, it's 6 hours. So Michigan is 6 hours behind Brussels.
Yeah.
So by the time she wakes up, I'm already, she didn't know this, but I'm still alive in the hospital. But my poor wife looks at the picture and says, and imagines, of course, the worst.
Right.
And doesn't know what's going on. And then, you know, she sees the picture, she screams, wakes the girls up. And then, of course, it's not until a few minutes afterwards that her mom comes over and says, no, you know, Seb is in the hospital. He's in critical condition, but he's alive as of now. And so, you know, she's what she went through for those moments when you don't know whether, you know, you're going to raise two girls by yourself or whether your husband is going to come back and maybe be changed forever, but still alive. You know, there's so many questions that run through your mind, and she had to face that. She had to face those moments. That's I think you bring up a really good point, Bob. You know, I'm not the only survivor. You know, I also have a wife and family and two daughters that also survived.
Right.
And so that's also the challenge, is to perpetually improve myself and overcome my handicap now for them, because they also went through, you know, horrendous moments, and still there's still tough ones out there today that strike us daily. You know, I wouldn't say as often, but there's still moments when my family really feels the impact of the last 2.5 years.
What's fascinating, this is basically a war zone. And I remember from the Boston Marathon bombings, one of the complications was this wasn't just somebody getting shot. You're getting the dirt and the potential infection that comes along with basically an IED or something along that line. There were bullets inside these bombs that penetrated your body. What did you end up injury-wise, and how long were you in the hospital?
Yeah, I had so my injuries were my left leg, so my tibia was shattered. So not only was it multi-fragmented, but the tibia shattered. So there were pieces of bone everywhere in multiple breaks, and then my fibula was also shattered. And so the bullet, the fragment of the bomb that went through my right hip shattered my entire hip. And so I had, you know, they had to reconstruct my hip. They had to put a piece of metal into my femur and then nail it to my hip socket to reattach it to my hip socket. And then in my tibia, what you said is very true. You know, I had so many open wounds. So I was for so long there was a huge hole in my right leg and, of course, you know, multiple holes in my left leg. So the risk of infection when you have open wounds in such a hellhole like an aftermath of a bombing,
yeah,
it's extremely dangerous. So they can't put any metal inside of you and fix you until they're sure, and even then, it's still a risk to put metal inside of you and fix you. So for 3 months, I had an external fixator to try to stabilize my bones because I did not want to lose my leg. I didn't want a prosthetic. I wanted to try, you know, everything that could happen in order to keep my legs. So after 2.5 months, I said, listen, we won't be able to save. We have to put metal inside of you because your bones will never be.
They won't be able to support you.
Yeah, exactly. It's too dangerous. We need to put metal through your tibia. And so that's what they did. So I have a very big nail, intramedullary nail in my femur, in my right femur, and then I have one also in my tibia. And I've lost all feeling from my knee down in my left leg. So I don't feel anything from the knee down in my foot, in my left leg. And but you know, I still got both my legs. I still got the original bones, and like I always say, I'm one of the lucky ones. I consider myself extremely lucky to be able to say that. Not only am I alive, but I still have, both my legs, and I may be handicapped for life, but to me, handicap is not something that it's not a bad word.
And I'm sure you had to relearn how to walk.
Yeah, I was in a wheelchair. People don't really understand, especially being a professional athlete, when the physical side has been so dominant, when you've worked so hard to reach the pinnacle of physical health in your sport, to be immobile, literally not to be able to move from a hospital bed for 3 months.
Wow.
I mean, I have a hard time not, staying still for 5 minutes. But here to be immobile in bed for 3 months, that's tough. It takes a lot of mental strength to do that. And then from the hospital bed, I went to the wheelchair. From the wheelchair, I went to a walker. From the walker to the crutches to a serious limp. And then eventually my journey continues every day to try to improve and overcome my handicap.
So next thing you know, after going through this rehab, I'm guessing you weren't really a marathoner before all this. When you're a basketball guy, you're sort of doing, it's a fast twitch thing. Up and down the court, hard, fast, hard. And now you say, I'm going to go run the Brussels Marathon. What the hell?
Yeah.
How hard was that? First of all, you didn't do it when your legs were fine. But now you're like, you know what? My legs are really beat to crap. I think I'll go run a marathon now.
Bob, let me tell you the truth. I couldn't stand preseason. I couldn't stand running. I couldn't stand that. I would jump rope. Yeah, I would jump rope a lot. I would do sprints. I was always really well conditioned, but long term endurance running was absolutely not my thing.
No, you're a big guy. That's big guys. That's sort of that big guys and marathon don't go together.
That's exactly right. But, when I talked about being 3 months in the hospital bed, not being able to move, and I knew that, to overcome this tragedy, to overcome what happened to me, I was going to have to focus and work my ass off to reach the other extreme. Because the extreme was getting blown up. That's one extreme. The other extreme that I started focusing on was to do the hardest endurance race there is that I know of, which is marathons or triathlons or whatever it is, very hard. Because through extremes, that's how you find your balance. So one extreme was getting blown up. The other extreme was, in however long it took me, one day I would run a marathon, one day I would do endurance. And through those extremes, you find your balance in life. So that became my obsession. That became my goal. I wanted to rebalance myself. I wanted to find my life again. I wanted to do it for my daughters, for my wife, for my family. And I wanted to say, okay, what's the method to rebalance myself after a tragedy like this? Well, extremes are not negative. Extremes are good. The problem is people stay at extremes. And so they unbalance themselves because they stay at extremes. So the way to find balance was to challenge myself to be able to do the opposite extreme of what I found myself in, which was a hospital bed, not being able to walk or move. So it became my goal. My goal was to say, okay, I'm going to do everything I can. I'm going to partner with anybody or any willing to help, run a marathon. And eventually when I run that marathon, then we'll find another challenging thing to do afterwards so I can keep finding my balance in my daily life.
So you run the marathon in, what, 5.5 hours, something like that?
5:22, Bob.
Oh, sorry about that. Five and change, right? Five and change.
Yes.
If you go 5:59, that's five and change. So you did five and change in Brussels. Yes. What was that? Is that in 16 and 17?
That was in
or 18.
That was 1 week. That was end of October 2018, so just a few months ago.
Yeah.
And then 1 week later, I had my 13th surgery. So I had planned it because I wasn't sure of the outcome of the 13th surgery. So I said, listen, before they take this opportunity away, let me run my marathon, the goal. So that's what I did.
What was the feeling like coming across that finish line? Because really, you're back in Brussels where all hell broke loose not that many years earlier.
Yeah, it was incredible. you know, it was, I was one of the last ones to finish, you know, and so it was, at the same time, it's humbling because you realize how much more work is possible to improve yourself. But at the same time, you know, running all those miles, in the city where my life took a change, it was very emotional, and it's amazing to be able to accomplish a goal that started out as a dream, you know, but that became a reality. Because I tell you, when I told people that, when I shared that dream while I was on the hospital bed, people looked at me and goes, okay, all right, here's the inspirational guy that wants to say things. You know, people didn't believe that it would be possible. But it can, you know, I created a really good team around me that was able to achieve that. And, so when I cross that finish line, it really is, the credit goes to all those amazing people that have, you know, dedicated their time and energy to help me overcome my handicap and achieve, you know, an incredibly positive, experience.
Seb, what was the lowest point for you through all this?
Lowest point. Tell you the truth, the lowest point came a week after that marathon, because I was riding so high that then a week later I had my 13th surgery, and they opened up my left leg, and in my left leg they found that there was 10 centimeters of nerve that had completely disappeared. So they were going to, the point of the surgery was to do a nerve transplant, to take little pieces of nerves from other parts of my body and transplant them into my left leg to help regain what they hoped would be regain sensitivity and regeneration of the nerves. But when they opened up my leg, they realized he's got a huge amount of nerves that just have disappeared, and it's not there. And so the surgery was a complete failure.
Oh.
And I woke up, you know, the surgery was supposed to be from 8 a.m. to 2:30 in the afternoon. And I woke up I woke up and it was 10:30. And I was like, what happened? And the surgeons came in and said, listen, we can't do anything more. You know, you're handicapped for life. There's just too much nerve damage for us to operate or do anything. So that really hit me. You know, I'm a person that really has always been, I believe that a handicap is something you can work on. You know, a handicap, it's like a golf handicap. You can always improve a handicap. And so, but when that moment hit me to say, listen, your handicap is here for life. Right now, there's nothing more that science or the medical field can do for you. Then it was almost like something hit me right in the face to say, like, all right, well, this is the reality. You know, I'm a handicapped athlete for the rest of my life. But from that moment on, again, I switched from being a victim to a survivor. I made the switch and I said, okay, I may never feel anything in my left leg again, but I will overcome this handicap and I will find ways to overcome it. So thus the new challenges that I've placed in my life in order to keep overcoming the handicap that now is a permanent reality.
So there's no feeling below the knee on one side?
No. No, and I've lost a big chunk of my left calf.
Oh.
So there's a big chunk of, you know, of tissue and muscle that they of course nerve graft, they did a skin graft,
right,
to close it, but there's a big chunk of missing in my left calf. So there's no feeling anything below the below the knee in my left side. I don't feel.
So a few weeks ago, get a call from our buddy Lars Fenanger, and Lars goes, "You got to meet Sebastian. Amazing backstory. And oh, by the way, doesn't own a bike. He swam a little bit, but he wants to do, you know, wants to do Ironman 70.3 Nice this year." And I'm like, okay, let's, I love this. This is what it's all about. Our sport changes lives every single day. And we've seen people come from the couch and get across an Ironman or an Ironman 70.3 or any triathlon finish line. So step number one was connecting you, since you're in Belgium, with the true legend, the two-time Ironman world champion, Luke Van Leerde, just to get a feel for, you know, one, to have him work with you and assess you. How has that been going since you got to meet Luke?
Wonderful. I mean, Luke is an intense guy, but we hit it off incredibly. You know, he's a very very dedicated, very focused person. And at the same time, I think he had his big concern was my swimming.
Right.
The running and the bike, you know, physically, I'd find a way to get through that. But his big concern was swimming. But we went to I kept a few secrets from him that my mom is a retired physical therapist, and she was a big swimmer growing up. And so she always had me in pools. She always had me. So I'm not the world's greatest swimmer, but I do know how to swim.
That's a good start.
And so I saw positive excitement in Luke's eyes when on our first technical swim practice a few weeks ago.
Very cool. And so now he's going through an assessment process, right? And then we'll come up with a training program, with the goal being to do 70.3 World Championship Nice at the end of in September.
Yes, yes. So the way Luke works is that you first have to get in shape, so to speak, in
right.
order to start to be able to train with him. So because of my handicap, there's certain series, there's weeks of training with specific exercises, with specific training regimens that you have to do in order to get your body ready to start the main training with him. So it's fascinating because it's kind of like preseason, you know?
Right.
It's like preseason basketball where, okay, the season's going to start, but until Luke feels that my body is ready to be able to start, I gotta do a lot of those pain in the ass drills and everything that everybody doesn't that no basketball player likes at the beginning of preseason.
The other thing that just going back when you were knowing your body and knowing physiology, so you knew that your blood pressure was dropping when you were sweating profusely. You knew at that point that you were in danger.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's that's again another part of the story is that you, by knowing your body and knowing physiology, you were able to go, okay, this it's almost like you've got an instrument panel and you're in the car going, this isn't good.
Yeah, well, you know, to add, you're exactly right. To add to what you're saying, Bob, it I would even break it down even more.
Yeah,
you know, a lot of athletes, what we ask for is reference points. Whether it's data, whether it's feeling, whether it's feedback from coaches or training apps, whatever it is, we love data. You know, a lot of athletes are data driven, which I don't agree entirely with, but that's what experience does. Experience, when you focus in and you value experience and you value the knowledge gained from experience, well, what it does is it gives you very good reference points. So, for example, an athlete that is sweating ridiculously, you know, it knows that that's a symbol of or that's a sign of, that's a reference point. And so I knew that when you start sweating, you know, abnormally, that's your blood pressure, you know, given going berserk. And so that's even more important to breathe. It's even more important to calm your body, you know, to take deep breaths, to get in almost a meditation like stance,
right?
Sort of speak, and that's really what I did. You know, when I realized that I was dying, I was literally dying. That's what I did. I calmed myself. I breathed. And I took really a lot of deep breaths. I allowed no negativity to get into me. It's kind of the windshield wiper. You know, as soon as a negative thought or image, I saw something, I just would wipe it away. And it's like I created a shield around me where I only allowed positivity to bask inside, which I'm sure helped me. And I know that, you know, in the long run, looking back, those little things did make a difference for me, you know. And I know as well, you know, the funny story, which I don't tell a lot, but when I woke up, Tuesday afternoon, after hours of being, you know, stabilized in surgery, I thought I was severely burned. I thought my face was, because my face hurt so much And I was like, oh, shit, I got burnt. You know, my face is destroyed. I got bandages all over it and everything. And I start touching it, and it's so sore. And so I asked them to bring a mirror to me, and I look at my face, and it's fine. I mean, there's bandages on my head and everything, but my face is fine. And I'm like, why does my face hurt so much? This is a true story.
Yeah.
And they're like, well, in the ambulance, you started dying. You started dying, and what the medical personnel did is they started hitting your face as hard as they can to keep you awake.
Wow.
And so, like, one of the injuries, you know, I had shattered legs, hips, and everything, but what hurt me the most when I woke up was I had gotten slapped so hard in the ambulance that that's really what stung, you know, when I came to.
Wow. And they thought your face was on fire, and basically they were slapping you to keep you awake so you didn't die.
Yes.
Oh my God.
And I let her, and actually before the Brussels Marathon, the ambulance worker who was slapping me, you know, I know her name, I know, so she came to the starting line with her two daughters and her husband. And that was my inspiration. So that the person that physically kept me alive in the toughest moments, in that hour and a half I was fighting for my life, she was at the starting line to wish me luck before the marathon.
Wow, that is amazing. That is unbelievable. How has all of this changed you, Sebastian? Do you feel you're different now than you were before?
I always use the example that I always use to explain that, because a lot of people ask me that. I said, you know, I was always like this in a sense. I'm a very positive person.
Right.
I'm a very upbeat person. I have a lot of energy, a lot of love in me. But when something like this, when you experience something like this and you come out of it as a survivor and not a victim, I mean, that approach to life that already existed in me is even stronger. You know, it's so much more engraved in me. Like, I know that there is something about positivity, about positive energy, about creating a team around you, about, you know, not being the smartest guy in the room. Now, people are so afraid. They have that fear, that illusion of always wanting to be the best, of always wanting to surround them, be the smartest guy in the room. And I think the opposite. I think if you're always the smartest guy on your team, if you're the smartest guy in the room, you should leave the room. You should change things. You should find new challenges, because you only truly start living. You only truly start finding meaning of life and overcoming these hardships by surrounding yourself with people who can challenge you. If you surround yourself with people who don't challenge you, it feels good to be the smartest guy, or it feels good to be the best. But, you know, it won't really lead to a fulfilling life. So have the humility, have the humbleness to surround yourself with people that can really challenge you, that can really help you. And that's why, for example, you know, Michael Jordan. Was Michael Jordan the best shooter on his team? No, Steve Kerr was a much better shooter than him, pure shooter.
Right.
You know, was Michael Jordan the best rebounder on his team? No, Dennis Rodman was a better rebounder. You know, was he the best player on his team? Yes. He was overall by far the best player, but he surrounded himself with people that were better than him in certain facets. That's what I do. You know, people like you, people like people who have a passion for things where we can share experiences. That's how you become, you know, I think, fulfilled, is by overcoming a handicap. Yes, it's hard. Yes, it's not fair. Life is not fair. But by overcoming the handicap, that's actually how you learn to be, you learn incredible lessons in life that really leads to fulfillment.
When people go through something like this, a lot of times they feel like the clock is ticking, right? There's more urgency every day. I don't know. I was at a point where I could have died. Now I want to get everything out of every single minute of every single day. Do you find that that's you?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And it's this urgency to be efficient, you know, to be efficient with the second chance that I got at life. And the more, once you create that team, you know, I have four pillars that I really try to evoke every single day. One, I have a team around me. So I have a team of people from my family to people I admire to people who are constantly challenging me. I create a team around me, the Team Bellin approach. And then once you create a team, you have to constantly challenge each other to eliminate these illusions from your life, whether it's fear, complete illusion, hatred. Hate is such a is such an illusion. The only person that hate can only exist by choice.
Right. Now, that's true.
It can only exist by choice. And people waste so much of their energy hating, being intolerant, being closed-mindedness. And it really limits them. So eliminating these illusions causes you to have a much more focus, a much purer focus in life. And when you can focus, then you add objectives. And man, when you have a good team around you that is fearless, you know, that can really focus on objectives, you'd be amazed how much more of a chance you give your team and yourself the ability to achieve goals, to achieve opportunities that life places in front of you. And the last thing is the quality versus quantity. You know, people are obsessed with quantity in this world. You know, it's not how much you, it's always, you know, the stats. You're a good player if you average 20 points. No, you're a good player if you win.
Right.
If you're on a winning team, you know, you're a good player. And you may, it may be a practice player, but you have a role on a winning team. And that's the importance. And so these four pillars is what I try to apply to my life every single day. And I know that that's what gives me the simplicity and the quality of my life that exists now is because of the experience. One of the experiences that the attacks overcoming my handicap, it continues every day.
So the triathlon, that's the new challenge. And you are, and when we talk about, you know, the advantage for something like basketball, it's good to be big. When you're in triathlon, and we've got, you know, Jan Frodeno, and a lot of the guys are, you know, 6'3"-ish, but 6'9" is a big triathlete. You are like anybody who's out there racing an Ironman, they want to be behind you, right? You are the ultimate wind block. You are the best wind block ever. You might be the tallest triathlete in history by the time you get to the starting line. And finding the right bike for you at 6'9", there's going to be some other challenges. We'll get through all of them. But also, you're now going to be part of our Challenge Athlete Foundation family, which I couldn't be more excited about.
That to me is probably the most important thing. You know, like I was saying, for me, a handicap, Bob, is not a bad word. And you look at all the members of your foundation,
yep.
Whether they have a handicap, whether they don't, they, you know, I use that example in my talks. I always say, look, a blind man is handicapped, but a blind man has found another way to see. It's different than you and me, the way we see, but he's found another way to see. A person who's deaf has found another way to hear. It's not the way you and I hear, but it's another type of hearing. And so for me, you know, challenged athletes have found ways to overcome. And if you take their skill sets, if you take their experience and you apply it to your life, you apply it to your hardships, it can be an incredible source of not only inspiration, but of real life, you know, concrete examples of that's how maybe I can overcome my challenges. And so that's what I'm fascinated by, too, is to partner with an incredible foundation and find ways for, like you say, a 6'9", you know, athlete who's severely handicapped, but we're going to together as a team find a way to overcome this handicap and compete and finish triathlons. And through that experiences and through you know the bike companies, the whatever companies it is that can help us achieve this, but yep. We're going to create a roadmap to help other people also, you know, accomplish their and overcome their daily problems.
What I love, Seb, is this is the beginning, right? This is the start of a journey. And being part of Team Bellin and being part of Team CAF, this is This is going to be a blast. This whole, from now through hopefully September with 70.3 Nice World Championships and hopefully Kona 2020. This is, I love the fact that you've got a roadmap out there.
Absolutely. Absolutely. The roadmap is, you know, every journey has a starting point, and I couldn't be more happier to start this journey with CAF. And most of all, with the people that you put together, Bob, the people that you are connected to, because it's going to take a team. And this team of people, you know, each person has their expertise. Each person has their experience. And if we gather all that around, we'll be amazed at what we can accomplish. And I'm sure we're going to do it. I'm sure it's going to be, and we're going to have a lot of fun doing it. That's for sure.
We're going to have so much fun doing it, and it's going to be. We'll be chatting numerous times on the show to go through that next accomplishment, because obviously there'll be little races along the way leading into 70.3 Nice, because we got to get the bike all dialed in and figure out how to get the world's largest wetsuit and. Yeah. And all of the above, because that water, the water in Europe is not that warm. Yeah,
it's all those challenges we were talking about. You know, it's. But again, I want to thank you, and I also want to thank life, because those are beautiful problems. After what I've experienced, Bob, you know, it's beautiful. It's a beautiful problem to have, to be able to have put myself in a situation where. We do have to find a big wetsuit, you know.
Not a problem.
So I'm very grateful for this opportunity. I'm very grateful for this journey, and I do want to kind of give a roadmap to all those people who have challenges in their lives, who have little problems. Let's create a roadmap, or maybe a timeline, a method for them to maybe. Get something from our experiences and apply it to their lives to overcome their daily problems.
I love it. Sebastian, thank you so much for taking time, and thank you for including me in the journey.
My pleasure, Bob. Talk to you very soon.
Again, Sebastian Bellin has been our guest. We are brought to you by the Tough Man Triathlon Series, toughmantri.com, by VeloFix, the world's coolest mobile bike shop, by Polar, Blood, Sweat, and Data, by CaliforniaTriathlon.org, five great 2019 race options, including Viking Dash Trail Run LA on April 7th, by our Challenged Athletes Foundation. This last year, 2,806 grants sent out, totaling $4.3 million to keep challenge athletes in the game of life through sport. Check out any of our interviews on iTunes or at Babbittville.com. And as always, endurance lives here.